And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Chris Cherniak, and I'm here with John Wells. And our first guest this morning is Brian Switek, who has written the book Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. In Skeleton Keys, Switek tells us that bone is a marvel, an adaptable and resilient building material developed over 500 million years of evolutionary history. It gives our bodies their shapes and the ability to move. It grows and changes with us, an undeniable document of who we are and how we lived. Arguably, no other part of the human anatomy has such rich scientific and cultural significance, both brimming with life and a potent symbol of death. Brian Switek, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, lots of questions. Fascinating book. Let's just start here. Mm-hmm. We're way back in time. When was the first, or where was the first evidence of bones within mammals or animals?
Okay, so the first bone, it wasn't like the bones that we have now. So the bones that we have now are really busy. There are cells in our bones that are constantly laying down new bone material. There are cells that are eating up old bone material. It's very dynamic and interactive. But the first bone was a substance called aspidin that shows up about 455 million years ago, basically on the outside of these fish that look like a Roomba with a tail, more or less. It was like armor. Mm-hmm. On the outside, mm-hmm. And it was like teeth in a way. Like, it didn't grow or react in the same way that our bones do now. It just kind of cemented on the outside as a sort of protection, only gradually started to become this more reactive sort of tissue. So it started as armor, basically.
Exoskeleton.
Yes.
And then at what point what's the opposite of exoskeleton?
Endoskeleton.
Endoskeleton.
Yes.
So when does the endoskeleton?
About 40 million years later.
Wow, that. Oh, 40 million years later.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so about 415 million years ago or so. So what happens is once bodies start to mineralize tissues, once you start to get stuff like the precursors of bone and the precursors of teeth, then that gets co-opted on the inside. So the skeleton already existed, and we know this because of earlier fossils that have the basis of a skeleton, but it's not made of bone. It's made of cartilage, more flexible material like sharks and rays and stuff like that that's still around today. So skeleton and bone are not necessarily synonymous. So the framework on the inside was there, it just wasn't mineralized. So once you have the mineralization on the outside and bodies can do that, that gets co-opted on the inside. So basically bone starts on the outside, is outside and inside, and then just goes inside.
Okay. So that was 40 million years after the exoskeleton, after mm-hmm. this armor that we're familiar with, when, you know, armadillos and, you know, other animals. But that was over 500 million years ago that bones actually started to show up. Is that correct?
So around 500 million years ago, there's the beginnings of a skeleton on the inside. Mm-hmm. But it's like a shark skeleton. It's made of flexible material. So a skeleton made of bone only shows up around, you know, 455 million years ago on the outside. And then the internal skeleton, the endoskeleton, is about 415 million years ago. So it's this step-by-step process. It wasn't just like a snap of the finger and then we've got, you know, a skeleton made of bone. It was there needed to be a framework and there needed to be the material, and then those came into sync with each other.
And the commonality of the framework, you know, the rib cage to protect the organs, the skull mm-hmm. to protect this intelligent stuff upstairs. How are a 190-ton blue whale skeleton similar to ours?
You know, it might seem funny to say this, but it's really just tweaks. Really, it's the same chassis. Like, if you think about it this way, that some people think about cars, like, you know, like Subaru might make one chassis and they have different models, you know, based upon that same framework. It's very similar with bone in that, you know, a blue whale has some of the same skull bones that we do. They have vertebrae, they have ribs, they have the same format of the way that their fins are laid out. There's an upper arm bone connecting it to the rest of the body, and then lower arm bones, and all the parts of their flipper is the parts of our hands and our feet. So this is the same framework that's been around. That's just, you know, little modifications in terms of, you know, what the animal is doing, what it's feeding, how it moves. That makes the difference. But you can look at the skeleton of any other vertebrate, whether it's a dinosaur, whether it's you know, a cheetah, whether it's a whale, whether it's, you know, a rat, whatever it is, and see the same bones, that we have a common ancestor. So really the vertebrate skeleton hasn't changed very much in about 400 million years. So, you know, there's a fish called the coelacanth. It's this, you know, right. really ancient kind of fish that was thought to be extinct. They right. found it in 1938. It has these fleshy fins with bones inside. And if you look at the skeleton of a coelacanth, you see the same things that we see in our skeleton. So in this ancient fish that's kind of like the icon of what our ancestors looked like 400 million years ago, our skeletons are more or less the same.
What about the chemical makeup of bone? Has that changed over time? Is it still primarily the same elements and compounds?
That's right. It's primarily so. Bone is a combination of a mineralized part and a flexible part. So you have the mineral part called hydroxyapatite. That's the hard part of bone, and the flexible part is a protein called collagen. And you need both of them because if it was just the mineral part, our bones would shatter. They'd be incredibly brittle. If it's just the flexible part, we'd collapse into a heap. They won't be able to support us at all. So it's that combination of the hardened part and the flexible part that makes bone so resilient. And the tissue bone, whether it's in another animal or in us, it's the same. And with the exception of that early precursor called aspidin that didn't really react, it just kind of accreted. Once bone tissue proper showed up, it's the same. So in, I had somebody ask me, like, was that the reason that they put, like, horses down sometimes is because their bones don't heal? It's like, no, of course they do. They react and grow and respond to change just like ours do. That's what makes bone such a wonderful building material.
But is it primarily lots of calcium and magnesium and manganese and other common elements like that?
That's right, yeah. And that's actually what was required for bone initially to evolve. So back in the ancient oceans, we have to think about this on a global scale that, life is reacting to the situation that it finds it in, right? So bone only appeared after you had a lot of erosion on the early continents at that time, well over, 455 million years ago, where a lot of calcium and magnesium and these other elements are basically being washed off the continents into the oceans, and suddenly there's something to build with.
Okay.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Brian Switek. He has written a fascinating book, Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. You've done a lot of research on bones. Every chapter is just chock full of all sorts of cool anecdotal stories and information that I've never known before. With all of your research, what have you learned that has surprised you the most?
A lot of this was relatively familiar to me because I spent my career writing about dinosaurs and skeletons and fossils and things like that. And as we were just talking about, like a lot of, I can look at the skeleton of a T-Rex and say, okay, those are the same parts and get an understanding of them. It was the cultural and the social aspect of bone. So, I remember going back to my college education, taking human anatomy classes, some anthropology courses, and some of the stuff that we didn't really learn about was the early days of anthropology in America in particular, and how it started out as a racially focused science. That was the obsession of the early anthropologists and archaeologists, was dividing people into these five different groups and then ranking them. And basically this is the dark side of anthropology that, understandably, probably they don't want to talk about terribly much, and thankfully we've largely moved beyond. But this aspect of the way that we studied ourselves and what we thought about that and how that's influenced what we think about where we came from and what our culture is. So that early history of anthropology and some of the problematic nature of that history is, I think, what surprised me the most during my research.
And that wasn't hundreds of years ago. I mean, it was hundreds of years ago, but it was also taking place in the 50s and the 60s.
That's right. It really took World War II and the horrors of the Holocaust to really change the main interest of anthropology in America. So it started out as this racially focused science, not only trying to divide people, but to rank them. And basically, it was a way for those in power to stay in power, some science being used as a tool to sort of maintain the status quo. And even as anthropologists were discovering, actually, race is a social and cultural construct. There's no biological backing to this whatsoever. There's an anthropologist by the name of Franz Boas who basically studied immigrants in New York who were arriving at the beginning of the 20th century, comparing the cranial measurements of the children to the parents and trying to see, okay, are these things inherited? Are they variable? Do they depend on stress and nutrition and all that sorts of stuff? And that's what he found, that it's incredibly variable, that any kind of dividing line that you try and make, it gets shattered because we're an incredibly variable species. But his community, the other anthropologists, basically didn't either accept that or they thought, well, maybe a new American race is forming. They either misconstrued the results so they didn't take it in. And it took basically what happened, the sort of the terrible extension of those sorts of thought processes during the Second World War, for the anthropological community to say, okay, maybe we've been looking at the wrong thing this whole time and we should really shift what our focus is.
So bones, skeletons, or structure have evolved over time. Mm-hmm. Is Is there an evolution that continues as we look ahead? Do we see our skeleton changing in some way?
So as humans, we still are evolving. Most of that evolution is genetic. In fact, the rate of genetic evolution is increased now over what it was about 100,000 years ago or so. And this involves a lot of things like lactose tolerance and sort of the habits that we have, like as we've eaten different foods and moved around the world. In terms of our skeletons, we haven't really seen that yet. But I am curious, particularly like, let's say 100 years in the future, we finally get to Mars and, you know, we're starting to live there or live in other places. And these are different environments with different gravity and different sort of environmental, you know, aspects to them. And then we might start to see some changes to our skeletons. But as it is now, it's hard to tell, but we can change our skeletons. This is one of the neat things I learned in the book, that people traditionally, I don't even want to say traditionally, in various parts of the world at various times, for example, have extended the shape of the skull, basically by wrapping cords or boards like around the heads, particularly of children, as they grow. They're able to get this extended sort of, not cone head shape exactly, but that's something that we can do, that we can mold our skeletons in certain ways. And this has no effect on intelligence, has no effect on, you know, any other aspect of our biology. It's basically a cultural look, like the same way that I've got a whole bunch of tattoos. If I used to live like on the Asian steppe while the Huns were moving through and I was a kid, my skull might have been elongated because that was just the fashion at the time.
Right.
And it's not just skull wrapping, it's also corsets, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's something I was fascinated by. There's a skeleton in particular at the Mütter Museum in Philadelphia, someone who had been corseted for much of her life. And the shape of the ribs have changed. They sort of droop into this S shape that the spines on the vertebrae have sort of come out of their normal orientation. It looks kind of gnarly. This has got to be painful. This has really got to have affected this person's biology. And it turns out that's not the case at all, that really there's no biological effect to this. It's just a skeletal marker of how the skeleton responds to being wrapped in this different way. And I found that kind of amazing, that our skeletons are so resilient that you can do something as dramatic as change the shape of some of your bones and be perfectly fine.
You know, going back to racial anthropology, it used to be, if somebody called you a Neanderthal, it was probably an insult. Now it might be a compliment. I mean, we've learned that these people have this beautiful cave art, that they've adorned themselves with very, you know, with certain types of jewelry, maybe not shiny metal, but with some really old type pieces and rocks and things like that they'd put around their necks for jewelry. What have we learned about the Neanderthals?
I
think we're all part Neanderthal, aren't we?
Yeah, for the most part. So I was going to, you know, build to that one, but might as well just jump right in with it. I haven't had my own 23andMe test done, but as someone of Western European descent, I probably have some Neanderthal genetics in me, as do probably most people on the planet. We used to think of them as a very separate species. The earliest restorations of what they look like were very ape-like, very brutal, sort of kind of stereotyped version, the sort of the slur version of what Neanderthals were like. Now, they're incredibly like us. Their skeletons are often a little bit different. Their nasal openings are a little bit bigger. They have a little bit stouter build. It's thought to have to do with living in primarily cold environments. But that not only are we part Neanderthal, but we shared a lot in common with them. As you're alluding to, one of the more recent discoveries is that cave paintings that were previously attributed to our cultural ancestors and thought that Neanderthals didn't do this, they didn't paint in caves, they didn't have symbolism that we do, it turns out that they probably made those, that they had, you know, possibly music, that they, you know, for example, buried their dead and put in grave goods with them, that they had some understanding of death in the afterlife, that this wasn't just what was originally interpreted as just chucking a body in the cave and, you know, there was some garbage or something else there. Now we've figured out that these were actually very careful, intent burials, so that they were much more like us than we previously thought. It was another case of, you know, in science, we have fact and we have theory, right? So there's what we observe, there's, you know, nature as it exists, and then there's our theory of what explains that or how these things go together. But if your theory is kind of garbage, then you can misinterpret the facts in front of you. So when you're starting with the stereotype, or that person can't possibly be intelligent, can't possibly be like me, then you're going to miss quite a bit. So once we've started to actually look at the evidence a bit more objectively, the more we find we share in common with Neanderthals.
I want to go back to bone and bone health, bone diet, because you talk about fact, theory, and when it comes to bone health, there's also myth. Mm-hmm. So what can you help us understand proper bone health and diet, and also disabuse ourselves of some of the myths that are out there?
Yeah, so I'll share a little bit about that. I want to preface this by saying, like, I'm not a medical professional. Yes. I'm not, you know, giving advice. But so, for example, people who go into space and live in zero-G environments, people go into, like, the International Space Station, stay up there, they lose about 1% of their bone mass every month. So when they actually they come back...
12% a year, if more, if not more.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. So this is, if you remember the movie WALL-E, like, all the humans in that are all kind of, like, they're like big babies and they're kind of wobbly and stuff like that. It's a logical extension of this idea that people in space for that long would lose a lot of their bone mass and kind of be wobbly and have to get around in, like, you know, electric lounge chairs. So when you know, these people who, you know, actually spend time in space come back, they actually have to be careful about not breaking their bones. It's basically, it's very similar to osteoporosis, which many of us, you know, deal with here. And one of the reasons that this is that our bones need stress to be healthy. This is why exercise is important. This is why if we, you know, the counterexample to this are black bears, which are probably coming out of hibernation, you know, about now-ish.
Mm-hmm.
They sleep for months on end. They sleep through the winter. But they have enzymes and other chemical compounds in their bodies that prevents their bones from jettisoning calcium into the bloodstream and losing bone mass in the same way. We don't have that. So if we, you know, as much as I would like to sleep through the winter, if I did that when I woke up, my bones would be incredibly unhealthy. I would have lost some of my bone mass because I'm not moving around. The bone cells that go about eating bone would have been rather too active, and the ones that put down new bone in response to all that moving and shaking wouldn't have done their jobs either. So this is something that, you know, we see either, you know, during our lifetime or when we go into other environments. And there are other animals like black bears that are able to sort of get around this problem and might give us some answers as to how to fix this in ourselves. But yeah, as far as, you know, bone health, that is one of the things that our skeletons need. They need to be active.
They need to be active. They need to be probably hydrated, much like every other organ in our body.
That's right.
Because there's the marrow.
Yeah,
that's
where we get our blood cells from.
Who came up with the marrow and bone? Who designed that? Where did that come from? That's amazing, because no marrow, no me.
That's right. And I like the point that you just brought up that, you know, we think of bones often as this relatively static system. That, you know, you just have the skeleton that you have, and, you know, your muscles are attached to it, and that's about it. But it's just as vital and responsive as any other part of your body.
Right.
There's a piece in the book about Richard III,
mm-hmm.
whose skeletal remains were found under a parking lot in 2015. And you go through really, really good thoughts on how CT scans, isotopic analysis, comparative analysis, and all of that. The question I have for you is, mm-hmm. how did they first begin to read that skeleton when they unearthed it?
So when
what are the different pieces that go into this, trying to figure this out?
Right. So I picked Richard III not necessarily because he was famous, but because, you know, as a long-lost king, that, you know, no one knew where his body was until they found it underneath this parking lot, that they're going to pull out all the stops in terms of analysis that they might not do for just a random skeleton that they find, you know, elsewhere, which sometimes happens. In terms of how they started to read it, immediately, from what I understand, when they uncovered that skeleton, they saw that this skeleton had something interesting going on with its spine, that it kind of kinked in one direction, was relatively short. This is a condition called scoliosis. Mm-hmm. And given the legend of Richard III, you know, having a hunchback and a withered arm, you know, propagated in Shakespeare's play, they thought, okay, well, this, you know, that's not exactly what, you know, Shakespeare wrote about, but this is something similar. This is a pathology. This is something interesting. So maybe this is our guy. So then you go about basically looking at the rest of the skeleton, you know, looking, number one, for pathologies, because pathologies tell stories. Those are injuries or signs of disease or things that happened in life. And not only did they find that, you know, evidence of scoliosis, they found all sorts of cut marks and wounds, basically, mm-hmm. from the conclusion of the Battle of Bosworth, in which Richard III died. And those are all things that you can sort of view on the outside and take CT scans and get a close-up view at some of these cut marks and these other things. But the isotopic analysis, the chemical analysis, basically taking a bone sample and looking at these chemical traces that are related to where his drinking water was coming from, the food that he was eating, where that was coming from, being able to tie tie the skeleton back to specific places, you know, through these chemical signatures, because as we eat and drink things, those traces get wrapped up in our own bones as they grow and remodel themselves. So it was, you know, you sort of work from the outside in, first looking at the sort of gross anatomy and then working through, if you have the tech, into, okay, what is the microstructure of this bone and what does it say about how old this person was, where are the chemical signatures inside this and what they were eating. So it's really amazing the information that our skeletons collect and that we can get out of them.
And how does DNA inform us of what a person possibly looked like? Because that was one of the last steps they did with Richard.
Right. So DNA, it's, you know, bones contain some of our, you know, genetic code. It starts to degrade at death. So the longer a skeleton has, you know, been in the ground or been dead, the less you have to work with. I think the limit is, under ideal conditions, about 6 million years. So no Jurassic Park, unfortunately. But they were able to get some, you know, genetic traces out of these bones and look at some things and look at hair and eye color, because these are some things that are mapped and are genetically passed down. So I think they said that the hair color of Richard III didn't match what was in the last portrait, but then again, that portrait wasn't drawn from life. That was drawn, you know, hundreds of years after. And it came, so the portrait is brown-haired, but it came back blonde. And he said, well, some people are blonde when they're kids, and it darkens as they age, so it's still relatively consistent. The eye color, I think, you know, the relatively light eyes that was consistent with this portrait. So, you know, this is sort of like fact-checking, saying, okay, we have this cultural representation of this person. Let's look at the skeleton, you know, everything from the anatomy to the DNA, and see if it matches. And it was, you know, it came into sync, and it was the mitochondrial DNA, the DNA that's in this organelle in our cells that is passed down through matrilines, basically on the female side, that was able to confirm that he had modern relatives, and basically working with the historical records to double check and say, okay, this really is Richard III, not just someone who happens to have scoliosis from the same time period.
Well, we just have time for one more question.
I just want to know real quick, what is the red market? And okay, people can learn a lot more about it reading the book.
Yeah, so the red market is a term that journalist Scott Carney came up with. This is the trade in human body parts, everything from hair to blood to organs to bones. And there is a large market for bones, even places where, you know, they've been export banned. They still find their way out, and we're still dealing with that, basically, you know, not looking at skeletons as objects, but these were people, and do they really want to be on somebody's mantelpiece as a collector's item?
And Instagram and Etsy, it's amazing. That's the leading way.
And again, you're talking about human bones, not just animal. Right. These are human bones that have a great popularity of their, or they're those people who really enjoy collecting them, owning them.
Yeah. There's a huge market for this, and it's really something that needs to be addressed.
Brian Swietek, written Skeleton Keys, The Secret Life of Bone. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Brian. Oh, thank you so much for having me on. This has been great.
Yeah. When